Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate you coming down.
Don't tell me you didn't like them.
I'm afraid I didn't.
How is that possible?
You see, Mr. Epstein...
It's Epstein.
Yes. As I was about to say, it is my job, Mr. Epstein, to feel the pulse of the record-buying public. And it's my sense that guitar bands, like these chaps, are simply on the way out.
You are absolutely wrong. These boys are going to be bigger than Elvis. Come to Liverpool. See them perform. See how the audience is responding.
Liverpool is not London, Mr. Epstein. I know you have a very profitable situation up there. If I were you, sir, I would just tend to that.
Well, I am not you, sir. And someday you are going to kick yourself for this decision.
I hope the bastard kicks himself to death someday.
So that was the first song tracked by the Beatles on New Year's Day 1962 at the Decca Studios on Broadhurst Gardens in West Hampstead, northwest London.
That place still exists?
Yes, it does, actually, although it's no longer the studio. The last time I saw it, I think it was part of the National Opera in the UK, yeah.
That's interesting.
The Beatles tracked three original songs, and that was really at the urging of Brian, who got the sort of thin end of the wedge over the years because people sort of thought it was Brian who'd pushed the Beatles to record all these novelty numbers and show their versatility.
I'm not really sure where that came from, but that's a story that had gotten legs through the years.
Yeah.
That they kind of laid it at his feet just as they lay at Dick Rowe's feet, the A&R guy at Decca,
yeah,
that the Beatles were turned down,
right,
and that wasn't quite the whole story.
Correct, yeah. So today we're going to basically go through the Decca audition and also play some of the original versions of the songs that the Beatles covered that day.
Yeah, which is interesting. Of the 15 songs they tracked in 1 hour that day, three of them are Coasters covers.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an interesting kind of – when you think of the Beatles and who their influences were and whose catalogs they deeply mined, the Coasters aren't the first ones to trip off your tongue.
No, that's right, because you've got one from Chuck Berry, who you'd think, you know, that was a huge influence on them.
Yeah, one Buddy Holly.
One Carl Perkins.
Yeah. So those are the ones that you tend to associate with the Beatles because they did go on to do a lot more covers,
right,
you know, both what was documented at the Star Club as well as what was done on the BBC.
Yes.
You know, Chuck Berry, I think we determined one day they did more songs in their repertoire from Chuck Berry than any single other artist.
Right. Really, the Coasters on this day, what they were recording were mainly novelty numbers.
Yes. Which is how the whole thing has gotten sort of typed as, you know, the Beatles showing up, showing off their versatility.
Yeah.
And really, you know, for an audition to make records, they're in there doing their stage act.
Yeah.
And you can easily, you know, with the funny voices and the way they would, you know, make faces and do all this other stuff on stage. Mm. It's like, what the hell do they think they were doing?
I know. I know. Were they thinking of themselves as also, you know, potential TV artists if they get a deal? So it's like, well, hey, you know, maybe on TV they'll want us to do Yakety Yak.
Right. With Zeppo Marx on drums.
Right.
It is interesting that this array of material that, you know, through the years has been issued on many gray market releases.
Mm.
I know for the legitimate anthology stuff, when it came out, they only did a handful of the songs.
Mm.
You know, two of the originals, two of the three, as well as Sheik of Araby, Three Cool Cats, and Searchin'.
Yes.
So it's an interesting snapshot of them, you know, basically – on the cusp of fulfilling their ambitions. They always wanted to make records.
Mm.
And these are the songs that in their thought process they selected, which aren't even all that representative of what was in their life set at the time.
It's interesting, isn't it? There's no Elvis. There's no Jerry Lee Lewis. No Little Richard.
Well, I was going to say, Little Richard is the most conspicuous omission.
Yeah.
Because we know what was in their set. You know, Long Tall Sally.
Isn't that amazing that they wouldn't do Long Tall Sally?
Yeah. Or Ooh My Soul,
right,
which was a huge song. We know that they were playing around that time.
Yeah.
And eventually they would do it for the BBC.
Right.
It's just very striking that they instead rely so heavily on the Coasters and this other stuff. Also, what's interesting is the story that's come through the years is that it was George who, you know, had more of a leadership role then than he would once they started recording for EMI. A lot more lead vocals when they're doing the covers and all that stuff. Anyway, it was he that pushed for them during this audition to record something contemporary, something that was an actual hit of the day.
Yeah.
And so that's how he gets to do the late Bobby V's Take Good Care of My Baby.
He wasn't late at the time, but he's late now.
He's quite late now and ever after will be.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a Goffin King song.
Yeah.
But he does a great job on it, and a song that you have to figure they must have learned on the fly, because that's not the kind of thing, that teen idol stuff, and this is with all due respect to Bobby V, was not their normal sort of thing. They were very discerning in their, you know, choosing material.
Yeah.
You know, they went for the authentic rock and roll stuff, not this stuff with sort of the manufactured sheen to it.
But they were doing stuff like Sheila, as we know.
Yeah, well, you know, I wouldn't put him in the teeny bopper category at all. He was a self-made guy, wrote his own songs.
Right.
Tommy Rowe.
Right.
But, you know, Bobby V, who was a talented guy, wrote his own songs sometimes, not always. That was more brill-building, manufactured
it was,
sort of pop idol stuff.
But also you've got the strong Buddy Holly connection with Bobby V, and we know how
you
much
do. I don't know that they were thinking of that, but it was a hit of the day, not their normal sort of thing, and that's what they did. And it is one of the standout tracks because George is so confident in taking it on.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute, but like Dreamers Do, which we opened the show with, you know, that's an early McCartney composition.
Yeah.
And
it's kind of a brash decision to lead with that.
Yeah. Considering they've only got three originals.
Three that they played that day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like, yeah, let's open with one of ours. It is.
Yeah.
Eventually, they gave that away to an outfit called the Applejacks.
Yeah.
And it was a hit in June of 64 in the UK, a minor hit. I think went to number 20 in the charts.
Yeah, it's interesting that this material, the sort of cast-off stuff that the Beatles never returned to, like Hello Little Girl, like Dreamers Do, you know, the stuff that they were kind of farming out. I mean, they'd so advanced by the time the public got to hear other artists, you know, playing this stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, such was their cachet as hit makers that, you know, these other artists were looking to get their foot in the door, you know, as hit makers, like Cilla Black,
right,
with Love of the Loved.
Yeah.
B-grade Beatle material was perfectly acceptable for these guys.
We have to sort of also, for context, say that the Beatles had travelled down to London from Liverpool on New Year's Eve.
Yes.
Of 1961.
And they'd partied along the way.
Yes, they had.
But we know that Brian took the train.
Yes.
And he was present for the audition.
Right.
Now, there is the story connected to the Deck audition, and in many tellings it's been put at EMI, but that he made some suggestion through the intercom while they're out on the floor, you know, recording, and that Lennon yelled something, you know, very insulting back at him.
Yeah.
I mean, even Mark talks about this in Tune In, but I don't know. He was a little unsure if that actually happened at Decca or if it happened elsewhere.
Right.
But it has been connected in time to the Decca thing, and that Brian went away for 20 minutes before he came back and collected himself.
In Pete Best's book, the first one, he basically recalled that they were having a go at Brian about the material. And I think
at Decca?
Yeah, at Decca. And that Lennon made some kind of anti-Semitic remark.
As is his wont.
Yeah, and that none of, you know, the Beatles, as was their wont, didn't say a thing. They just stood by and, you know, let that one fly.
Yeah, I wouldn't take Pete's word as gospel.
With all due respect. Certainly not.
Yeah. I mean, I would take other sources as being more authoritative. And there were other witnesses there, engineers as well as Mike Smith. So
what we do know is that they did arrive with a load of battered gear, as they would do when they would get
to EMI.
Well,
that was what they had, yeah. I mean, Paul had a homemade bass cabinet.
Right.
And not that he'd made it, somebody else in Liverpool.
The El Pico.
It was, whatever it was, but it was, there was buzz going on.
Yes.
You know, not unlike the scene in Help where they're doing You're Gonna Lose That Girl.
Right,
well,
right.
It wasn't a chainsaw.
Yeah.
And it was something they had to deal with before, you know, they later came to the conclusion they didn't have to bring this lousy gear down in the first
place. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you've got Paul, who's type A dog, you know, in the Beatles.
Oh, yes.
You know, pushing them.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as is clear in Lewison's Tune In book, when it came to spending money on his gear, he wasn't first in line.
No.
And
then as now.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, give me free stuff.
So it's kind of interesting that Paul had, like, the lousiest gear.
Yeah, it was in the worst shape, although it probably, when fully functioning, was probably pretty impressive.
Well, that's fine, but it wasn't fully functioning.
No, but that was what they had. Plus, you know, whatever gear they'd stolen along the way from the Liverpool Art College and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So they lead with that, and then they go straight into John Lennon's performance of Money.
Yeah, for Motown, obviously, which is, you know, Barrett Strong's song from 1959.
Right, which is a great record.
Yes.
Although, you know, what you know they ultimately did with it at EMI, they just shredded the original. And they did some good live versions as well.
Not this one, though.
Not heard this day.
No.
No. And it is interesting that here now, Lennon has had some experience recording in a studio to this point, you know, having done Ain't She Sweet under the production of Burt Camfort back in spring of 61.
Right.
And so here he is, clearly nervous.
Yeah.
This is not the Lennon we know at all.
Well, we've said this before. It's really interesting that on this day, I mean, we'll put Pete Best to one side.
Yeah.
But in terms of the other three, George is the only one who really delivers.
Yes.
John and Paul are strangely restrained.
Or they're trying too hard in Paul's case. The way he's enunciating his words and his singing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
With nerves.
Yeah, clearly. Nerves, and this condition they were in from a night of partying and long travel before. So you got to figure they're knackered just from showing up there but under the conditions they had to get there, as well as nervous as hell.
They're also – yeah, they're out of their comfort zone, right? You know, they may be cocky on stage in Liverpool and Hamburg.
Right. With their people.
Right.
Among their people.
Exactly. But here they are, you know, in London and in the studio. And as Paul said, when that red light went on,
the term often used to describe this day is in awe of their surroundings.
Yeah. Yeah.
So things would change.
It's just kind of interesting. You said, you know, we don't have a Long Tall Sally or something where they really just let it fly.
Yeah. Not even some other guy.
Yeah. So Money is strangely muted. It's not what it would be.
No. Not what it was at that time in clubs. Mm.
So why don't we take a listen to the original by Barrett Strong and then segue into the Beatles' Decca performance.
Now, the next one we've played on the show before when we were showcasing George as a guitarist. Mm-hmm. And that was, we played a segment of the Decca reading of Till There Was You.
Yeah.
And so here you've got this ballad in their set, you know, that was fairly important to them. You know, we know that they did it at Star Club. They did it at Sullivan. They did it on TV in England.
Yeah.
Before the Royals. You know, this was a song, a big favorite of theirs that they dropped pretty much, you know, in early 64 once they got America out of the system.
Yeah.
So it was a good showcase showing their range.
They certainly used it.
Yeah. They're belying, you know, their leather appearance to do a tender ballad.
Paul said that he actually wasn't aware of The Music Man, which was 1957 musical. And he wasn't aware of Till There Was You at that time. It was the following year Peggy Lee covered it.
Which is very interesting because, again, it's a straight-up pop tune.
Yes.
And it's not anything remotely rock. There's no guitars you hear or anything like that. So the fact that he would hear this tune, he must have been captivated by the melody, and decide, hey, we can repurpose this and bring it into our set.
In his words, he has stated that, you know, the Beatles enjoyed doing material that was to the left and right of rock and roll.
Which was great because that made them stand out, as well as invaluable self-education for their own writing.
Yeah.
You know, this is, there's a big difference in the songwriting compositional structure of rock and roll versus pop standards, Tin Pan Alley, you know, Great American Songbook. So they're assimilating this stuff.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, you wonder, because we've talked about this on the show before, most of their lives they lived absorbing music that was not rock and roll.
Yes, correct.
And then when they became rock and roll, you know, it's like when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. It's like when you're a rock and roller, every song is something you could repurpose to your own ends.
But it's still interesting with this one because, you know, some of the songs that they covered, we know it wasn't, you know, the original version of those songs, but it was one that came to their ears, maybe in a rock and roll form, you know, with Gene Vincent or...
Right, which was a huge thing at that time. Yeah. You know, when you know, look no further than Tony Sheridan doing My Bonnie.
Yes.
You know, this ancient song that, you know, it's like you put a rock and roll twist beat on it and suddenly, you know, it's a hit record.
But the Peggy Lee version of Till There Was You really is a kind of pop standard sound. I mean, it's very sultry and it's... In fact, not the way that Paul delivers it, because it would be ridiculous for Paul to deliver it in that way.
But interestingly, you look at, you know, another breakout hit of Peggy Lee's within their years of playing as a band, Fever.
Yes.
Was another song that they did.
Oh, yeah.
Famously, they recorded it with Wally from Rory Storm in that first recording session with Ringo in October 1960.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you know, they're not limited at all by what's in the rock and roll charts.
Correct.
It's like anything is fair game.
Meadows of dawn, and you, there was love all around, but I never heard it singing. No, I never heard it at all till there was you. Music and wonderful roses, they'd send me in sweet, fragrant meadows of dawn. And you, there was love all around, but I never heard it singing. No, I never heard it at all till there was you.
So now this brings us to George's first performance.
Yes.
And boy, what a performance it is. It's the Sheik of Araby, which was actually, you know, written in 1921.
Yes.
And it was kind of in response to Rudolf Valentino's The Shake.
It was a thing back then, yeah. The whole Sheiks and Sheba thing.
Yeah.
You know, where you were, you know, young adults.
Yeah.
And that's what you identified with.
Right.
And so somebody wrote this novelty tune, basically. And the fact that it got resurrected decades later.
Yeah.
As a hit rock and roll song.
Absolutely.
You know, the Beatles' most immediate exposure to it would have been through their friend Joe Brown.
Yeah, because I know originally, like when Mark Lewisohn did his first book, The Beatles Live, his assumption, which is understandable, you know, looking at the various people who covered the song,
yeah.
It was Fats Domino, I think, in like 1955. So he assumed.
Fats Waller did a version too.
Right. So he assumed it was the Fats Domino version. But in the anthology book, George says that it was actually a TV performance by Joe Brown of The Sheik of Araby.
Which would have had to have been late 1961.
Yeah, correct.
And he was a more or less the Beatles' contemporary age-wise, but far more successful earlier on than they were.
Larry Parnes managed.
Yeah, exactly. Backing Billy Fury and appearing on TV.
And Joe Brown and the Brothers.
Yes. Yeah. So he actually had some pop stardom pre-Beatles. And they actually were looking to him. They would cover A Picture of You.
Correct.
In 62.
But so George said that's where they got the arrangement. Well, he got the arrangement from, basically. Yeah. It was seeing Joe Brown on the TV. At that time, Joe Brown hadn't recorded it as a studio version. And in fact, he would only ever issue it as a live recording.
Right. There's the live album he did in 63 called Joe Brown Live.
Yes.
Which he's got it on, as well as some other songs that were in the Beatles set.
Right.
Like Hallelujah, I Love Her So, Sweet Little 16.
Yeah.
I can't speak to Haba Nagila being in the Beatles set, but Joe Brown does it.
That would have been interesting.
Wouldn't it, though?
Do it for Brian. So here is the live version, but this, as I said, is
it's a latter day.
Yeah. And, but it gives us an idea as to the kind of arrangement that George would have witnessed on TV.
I'm the Sheik of
Araby.
The world belongs to me.
To me.
At night. When you're asleep,
asleep,
into your tent, I'll creep with me boots on, kicking up a dust of moon that shines up above.
Up above.
He gonna light our way to love. Oh yeah, you rule this great big world with me, 'cause I'm the Sheik.
I'm half
the salt, the chime, the bubble. We'll light our way to love. Are you rule this world with me? I'm the sheep of my ruby. Well, I'm the sheep of my ruby. Your love belongs to me.
That's very interesting that George would hear that and see that and think, yeah, we got to do this in the Beatles set.
Yes.
It is so corny.
If
that is anything like what he did it when George saw it, it's awful. But then you listen to the Beatles do it, and you know, as familiar as we are with it, and we've kind of accepted it as, you know, just a kind of an exceptional one-off sort of performance.
Yeah.
And they're definitely playing up the comedic aspects of it.
Oh, yeah.
It's still not them.
Not off.
Well, give me the history of that. I realize it's some kind of British thing.
Yeah, it's just an expression where you sort of say, like, you know, that was great. You go, well, not off, you know. As if
to say,
yeah.
When you say it like that.
Yeah.
Now I understand it.
Yeah.
Not half. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Not off.
And what's the thing that comes on the White Album right before While My Guitar Gently Weeps at the end of Bungalow Bill, what John does?
Hey, up.
Yeah, what is that?
That's a Liverpudlian expression, isn't it? Like, you know, it's a bit like, come, Ed. You know, come on. Hey, up.
Okay. Okay. Good. We got that covered now. So, Che Guevara beat.
That intro is so damn corny. It's like, you can't believe it's the Beatles doing that.
It's shorthand for Arabian, right? Musical shorthand.
Yes,
just like
absolutely.
You know, as used in the beginning of Turning Japanese and countless other things,
yes,
evokes the Orient,
right,
to round-eyed people.
Yes.
So, but funny enough, you know where that came from? It's got a Chicago base.
Really?
Yes. The World's Columbian Exposition, 1893. I happen to know this. Little Egypt, who was the dancer there.
Yes.
You know, with the, you know, yeah, scantily clad thing.
Yeah.
It was used as her intro music by a guy named, who's a promoter, Saul Bloom,
okay,
who ended up being a congressman later on,
okay,
oddly enough.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, he improvised it. And then it became this sort of, you know, oriental in the bigger meaning of the word, like, Eastern or otherworldly.
It actually doesn't emanate from the Middle East at all.
Not at all.
Wow.
Nor does chop suey come from, you know,
yeah,
China.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
But it ended up being one of those things that, because it was just this exotic thing, all the girls in pants never wear their underpants. You ever hear that? Yeah. So there's variants of it where it transcended its Cairo origins by way of Chicago.
Wow. So another great thing that Chicago's contributed to the world.
You got it.
Yeah. And without that, we wouldn't have had that fantastic intro.
Right.
George on this day is Mr. Novelty, isn't he? Because he's going to be doing Three Cool Cats in a bit.
Yes.
So,
well, at least that had the rock and roll credibility of coming from the Coasters.
Yeah. The great thing for me was when I saw Paul perform at Wrigley Field in Chicago in, I think, 2012.
Yes.
Beforehand, sort of outside the stadium.
The sound check.
Yeah, the sound check. And there was the Sheik of Araby,
mm-hmm,
playing all over Wrigleyville. It was amazing. And I just remember thinking at the time, my God, if they'd have known New Year's Day 1962.
Right. That, come, you know, to this.
All these years later, yeah, you know, 50 years later, in Chicago, USA, it's going to be sort of blasted all over the city.
You guys are going to know us.
So then we get to a track that I really do like the Beatles cover version of, which they never put down on record, you know, in the studio. But we've got them doing it BBC, you know, various sort of iterations.
Star Club.
Of it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so here it is, To Know Her Is to Love Her, which the Teddy Bears from 1958.
Yeah. And little did they know their connection with Phil Spector years to come.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
But they do. I always thought this was one of John's best performances as a singer.
Yeah.
Maybe not necessarily this one at Decca, because, you know,
again, it's more restrained.
It's
isn't
more
it?
Restrained. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it definitely is a hint to the latent soulfulness he would have in this kind of material that would manifest itself at EMI and some of the other BBC stuff.
And here we have them pre-blended backing vocals, where it's, you know, the sort of doo-wop, doo-doo-doo-doos, and da-da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the bit in the bridge section where they're just George and Paul, doo-doo, doo-doo, doo-doo.
We'll play a bit of this one. And, of course, most people know that it was originally sung by a girl singer.
Yeah.
To Know Him Is to Love Him.
Yes.
And it was a big hit in 58.
Yes.
I believe, when that
came out.
Yeah. And so, you know, that was really Spector's claim to fame pre-producer as a performer himself.
That she was meant just for me.
That original was sung by Annette Kleinbard.
Right. That's not her stage name, though.
No. Eventually, she changed it to Carol Connors. That'll fool them.
Yeah, really. Yeah. She's still around. I've seen her talking about Phil.
Oh, well, yeah. Plenty to say there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they never managed to get any kind of follow-up hit after that. But, you know, it's an evergreen.
Yeah, and it's a twee vocal, but a very pure vocal by
yeah.
her. So anyway, up next, we basically got George again in the spotlight with what we mentioned before, Take Good Care of My Baby.
And again, this is as best as the research and educated guessing allows us to know in what order they played the songs that day.
Yeah.
You know, they did this in an hour, 15 songs. There's no extant false starts or outtakes or rehearsals or any of that stuff. We could presume that everything wasn't just nailed in one take.
Right. This is coming from the disc that Brian was hawking around to the record companies.
Yeah, which was the one lasting thing of value to come out of that day's work.
Yeah.
But as we mentioned, this is a very confident delivery of a song that they could not have really had around in their repertoire very long,
yeah.
assuming they even played it after this day.
Yeah, the only thing is that, again, being just a four-piece band,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just guitars, bass, drums, it's got a weedy sound like most things do on this day because it is. It's just an audition. You know, they're not doing overdubs or anything like that. So I think that's what people have also got to understand. But it's not exactly a full-bodied performance of the song.
No, you know, trying to envision this being done at the Cavern or even at the Star Club.
You know, you could have given it a lot more balls, right?
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I'm sure it would have been, you know, amphetamine filled.
Yes.
Just to blast through it. But this was a pretty big record in 1961 for Bobby V. And it's Goff and King, who we know the Lennon and McCartney were fans of.
Yeah.
And that's who they sort of cast their
aspirations. Yeah, they aspired to be the Goffin and King of Britain.
Right, for sure. So,
yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it is just an interesting selection of songs that this wasn't the kind of thing they normally did.
It's just the, you know, like the guitar at the intro, it just sounds so, it's almost like he's plucking on a rubber band.
Well, you know, that kind of George Harrison playing was manifest this day,
yeah.
I hate to say.
Yeah.
You know, some of the solos you hear him take, you know, he's definitely not in top form.
Right.
Although there's other things he does quite well that he nails, like Till There Was You.
Mm.
But, you know.
Kind of foreshadowing his BBC radio performances.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely seems to be a learning curve there, no matter what he was doing live. And, you know, most the early things we got is a Star Club. And mostly there, he's just on fire. You know, he's doing a great job. But, it's funny how in a studio environment or without an audience, you know, sometimes I don't want to say choked, but he's definitely not the George that we'd come to know later. That's for sure.
But also we've got to remember, you know, he hasn't got an array of pedals there for his guitar. Right?
Well, he never needed them.
Right. But yeah, but I mean, in later years, that would have been the case. They'd have arrived with their pedals and fattened the sound up.
Yeah, and then they'd have string samples on the keyboards and all that other stuff.
Yeah, wah-wah.
That's another band we're talking about. What is interesting, too, in this arrangement, you hear that bit of McCartney harmony toward the end.
Yeah.
So there is an effort being made for this to be sort of a group performance.
Mm.
But I've always liked the song. Okay.
Yeah. You know? Oh, I love the song. I think it's a great pop hit.
Yeah. And there's something about hearing George sing it. It's like I don't think John could have pulled it off.
No.
Paul maybe, but it would have been different.
Yeah.
It seems ideally suited that sort of bittersweet tone to George as the one watching his girl go off with another guy.
I suppose they could have done it as a trio, you know, sort of three-part vocal.
Yeah, they could have made it a this boy.
Yeah. Yeah. Something. but you know, with George, it's interesting because he's actually in head voice and it's so delicate, his vocal. And it's not the kind of vocal that he would be performing 10 years later when he would be in much more whiny mode.
Well, it's not even the same kind of vocal he did this day on other material,
you
know, where he's doing more of the novelty stuff. And it's more that Scouser sort of intonation that we associate with him in the early days.
My tears are falling 'cause you've taken her away. And though it really hurts me so, there's something that I've gotta say. Take good care of my baby. Please don't ever make her blue. Just tell her that you love her. Make sure you're thinking of her in everything you say and do.
take good care of my baby. Now don't you ever make her cry. Just let your love surround her, paint a rainbow all around her. Don't let her see a cloudy sky.
Once upon a time, that little girl was mine. If I had been too, I know she'd never be with you. So take good care of my baby. Be just as kind as you can be. And if you should discover that you don't really love her, just send my baby back home. That you don't really love her, just send my baby back home to me. Take good care of my baby. Take good care of my baby. Take good care of my baby.
Clearly, Memphis by Chuck Berry was a favorite of John Lennon's.
Yeah.
You know, as late as 72 when he's doing it with the man himself and Mike Douglas.
Yeah.
Not very well. They did it at the BBC, and it was just one of these things that was part of their set along the way.
I know a lot of people love this song, and they love the irony in the lyrics.
Where he's only 6 years old.
Yeah, I know. I've never been blown away by this number,
nope.
Period.
No.
You know, even that irony, the twist in the tail, yeah. Big deal to me.
Johnny Rivers didn't do it for you?
But yeah, really, go tell it to Johnny Rivers.
But yeah. But here we see John, you know, starting to get a little bit more of his confidence.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the best reading we'd hear of other takes of the song.
I mean, but
him.
Again, why Memphis, Tennessee? Why not Johnny Be Good?
Right. Roll Over Beethoven,
right.
Sweet Little,
you know,
16.
Yeah, one where they absolutely are belting.
Yes.
You know, but no.
Stuff that they, you know, they'd have the muscle memory to do without even thinking twice about it.
Mm.
I mean, yeah, they did this song a lot too, but especially you want to show off your lead guitarist capabilities.
Yeah.
It's not a lead guitarist song.
I mean, the only song in this 15-song list that is an out-and-out rocker in the Beatles' hands is Money. And
yeah.
As we've already said, they're really restrained on that. And then there's not another number there where they can just rock their socks off.
No. But if you approach it from what was the Beatles' biggest strength at this point – it was their vocals.
Mm.
So if they're wanting to tip their selections toward things that show off harmonies and blended vocals, you look at it that way. Not that Memphis is that song,
no.
But a lot of the other material is.
Uh-huh.
So maybe that was what they were keeping in mind, and this was their token rocker, such as it is.
But, you know, like the album that we compiled, you know, the Beatles Live Anthology, and it starts off, you know, with Hamburg. And my God, when you're going from Kansas City to Sweet Little 16 – if they'd have just done that on this day, just one Paul vocal like that and one John one and let it rip in both cases,
right.
You know, that might have just blown the guys away in the control room.
Well, see, the difference is you have to have the sort of thing set up in your head, just this sort of mindset. You don't care.
Mm.
You're just going to go for it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're performing like people that don't want to upset anyone.
Correct.
You know,
yeah, they're really playing it safe.
They really are.
And it's not a Beatles trait.
No,
so they're not playing to their strength.
No, but you hear them at Star Club. You know, they're vaguely aware they're being taped, but they're really, you know, playing before another crowd of drunks, as they've done many, many times before, and wanting to get the hell out of this gig as quick as they can.
Right.
And yet those performances just rip.
Yes. Yeah. So this is really kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah. And it's the other end of the year, too. There was a lot of developments, a lot of things that, you know, got set in motion that year. So they're in a different place totally by December when we have those recordings.
Yeah.
So, you know, unfortunately, we don't have a whole lot from 61 going into 62 beyond the Tony Sheridan thing. So, you know, that's not much of a judge of where they're at in terms of their career.
So anyway, here's the 1959 original by Chuck Berry flowing into the Beatles' 1962 version.
station. Give me Memphis, Tennessee. Help me find the party. Try to get in touch with me. She could not leave her number, but I know who placed the call. 'Cause my uncle took the message and he wrote it on the wall. Help me, information. Get in touch with my Marie. She's the only one who'd phone me here from Memphis, Tennessee. Her home is on the south side, high up on a ridge, just a half a mile from the Mississippi Bridge.
I saw Marie, she was waving me goodbye. With hurry home drops on her cheek, trickled from her eye. Marie is only 6 years old, information please. Help me get in touch with her in Memphis, Tennessee.
Now, Shorter Fall, Cull Perkins, 1956. Wouldn't you have thought that George would be the one who would have taken the lead vocal chores on this?
It's more of a country song than a rockabilly song, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, Paul, as we heard in his BBC reading of it, you know, he has got that affectation going on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Shore too far.
Yeah. And then Ringo would take the torch for Stop and Smell the Roses. But I think it was less of George's thing. Mm. But at least they're paying homage to one of their musical heroes.
I know, but, you know, again, they're sort of doing it with this country ballad.
Yeah.
And
versatility.
Yeah. You know, where's Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby or Matchbox? Or,
right. Honey,
yeah.
Don't.
Yeah.
Right. No, not to be heard at this juncture or some of the other stuff that they were captured at Star Club doing. Ain't Nothing Shaking. You know, they're, Your True Love.
Right. Yeah.
Great,
that would
fast,
be great.
Up-tempo stuff that would showcase George's capabilities.
Yes.
For sure. No, just kind of don't.
So no.
You know.
Yeah. So here we got, like, you know, a maudling original by Cull Perkins.
Yeah.
It really is.
It's, you know, sweet. You know, it's a tender country ballad, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's got sort of a homey charm to it, but not the most, you know, not the biggest showcase for what they were good at.
It's so surprising.
Like, although it's got the harmonies.
You know, which Cull Perkins shall we do? You know, let's do Shorter Fall. I mean, really?
Sort of the theme of the day.
Yeah.
Really.
I'm sure to fall, fall in love. I'm sure to fall in love with you. You are so sweet, and we are so near. I'm sure to fall in love with you.
right, now we're on a little bit more comfortable footing than a lot of what came before.
Yeah.
And it's another Lennon-McCartney original, the second one of the day. And it's a John composition, one of his early songs. We've talked about this on the show before, especially when you hear that 1960 Quarrymen rehearsal tape from Paul's house, where it was a lot more Buddy Holly sounding than the reading they gave of it this day.
Yes.
But it's where you, again, start to see John getting a little bit more comfortable, especially by the last verse.
Yeah.
You know, been a long, lonely time.
Yeah.
Hello, Little Girl is a decent enough composition.
It is, and it shows off his vocals fairly decently as well.
Yeah, and you got some arranging things going on there with the vocals.
Yeah.
You know, so him and Paul singing together.
Yeah.
And
doesn't he claim it's one of the first things he ever wrote?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, well, they didn't take out One After 909 that day.
No.
But then it took them forever to get a handle on that.
Or I Lost My Little Girl.
Right.
Or Thinking of Lincoln.
Right. Yeah, none of those classics. But it's definitely one of the more fully realized early songs of theirs. I mean, it's got a beginning, middle, and end. You know, clearly in building it off a Buddy Holly framework, they had some confidence that this was going to work.
Yes.
And of course, you would have the Foremost having that song as a hit, one of their first hits in 63.
Yeah. Guess what number it went to? It's a John Lennon composition. You've got one number to choose.
9.
Yes.
Of course. Not that it really put them on a successful career path, but I mean, they had their, I think that was.
Yeah. I mean, Paul said that, you know, it was a song that just didn't work for them ultimately, you know, to be recording in the studio, and that the Foremost were kind of this novelty band in a way, you know, and so he said it was like the best they could do is give it away to them.
And which is fine. You know, at least the song didn't go totally wasted.
Hello, little girl. Say, you're my little girl.
When I see you every day. I'm quite happy with the performance the Beatles did this day.
Yes.
I think it's one of the better performances.
I agree, I think you hit the nail on the head and said that they sound more comfortable with this.
Yeah. Yeah, for whatever reason, although, you know, we haven't really talked much about Pete Best drumming to this point.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, why don't we start now, then?
Sure. With everything else that was subpar by Beatles standards that day, if you're listening with sort of fresh ears to this act that you're considering signing to your label, the one thing that's going to really stand out through all of these songs.
The Atom Beat?
Well, he's not even doing it. You know, maybe that would have made a difference. It is so perfunctory at best. I mean, no pun intended. You listen to the tempo variations throughout some of these songs here. Clearly, there is a very definite weak link happening. So,
it's that guy with the bass pedal, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That was your first mistake. But Decca never had to point to one single thing as the reason that they didn't sign him this day.
Right.
I mean, there was other more pervasive. They did say, though, one of the guys, I don't know if it was Mike Smith or the engineer that was there that day, that said, had we signed them, it would have been an Andy White situation.
Yeah.
They would have used a session drummer to get through the recordings. Because,
Clem Cattini.
Yeah, this just wasn't making it.
Right. And he's just got that kind of shuffle that he keeps doing on the snare. You
know? Yeah, he knows one fill.
Yeah.
And he applies it to everything, whether he needs it or not.
Yeah.
And this isn't to beat up Pete Best, okay?
Right. But there's no Atom Beat, right? We've got no examples of this Atom Beat.
No.
We have to rely on eyewitness testimony.
Yeah.
But
that it was something that made them dynamic and great in a club situation.
But again, you know, was it a group decision that we're going to play it safe? Let's not overdo it. Let's not be too raw. Let's be polished. You know, it may have been. We don't know if there had been some discussion beforehand because it is amazing. I know that they feed off one another.
Yeah.
But it's still amazing that they're all being restrained.
There's not a hint of amphetamines.
No, it's not a hint of any of that
stuff. Which would have, you know, maybe changed the outcome of the day.
Right. You know, just nothing.
Yeah, you don't get the sense of frothing at the mouth like they would do on stage.
It's just no guts to it at all.
Yeah. Yeah. No heart in it. But anyway, you know, you put yourself in that situation after hangover New Year's Eve and, you know, you're being in a real recording studio in London.
Yeah.
You know, it's something you've aspired to for a long, long time and, you know.
Here's the thing, though. How different would it have been with Ringo behind the kit?
I think Ringo was a seasoned enough professional by that time that he would have acquitted himself well.
Mm.
I mean, he was, you know, this man about town who,
yeah,
you know, despite his own lack of recording studio experience to that time. Mm. And he described being nervous at the Love Me Do session as well.
Yeah.
But he seemed to know when to assume the role of being the rock.
Yeah.
And I think it would have come very easily to him.
Mm.
Whereas I don't see Pete Best similar seizing the reins.
Hello, little girl. Hello, little girl. Hello, little girl. When I see you every day, I say, hello, little girl. When you're passing on your way, I say, hello, little girl. When I see you passing by, I cry, hello, little girl. When I try to catch your eye, I cry, hello, little girl.
Hello.
I send you flowers that you don't care. You never seem to see me standing there. There'll come a day when you say, you're my little girl.
Hello.
It's not the first time that it's happened to me. It's been a long, lonely time. And it's so funny to see that I'm about to lose my mind. So I hope there'll come a day when you say, you're my little girl. You're my little girl. You're my little girl.
Oh yeah.
You're my little girl.
So, we move on to Three Cool Cats.
Yes.
Another song that made it out on Anthology.
Yep.
So most people are pretty well familiar with it.
Coaster's track from 1959.
Yeah. Another novelty track. And again, it's sort of this comedy number because they're doing the funny voices in it. You've got Lennon doing, you know, his little Peter Sellers version of an Indian accent and a German accent for comedic effect.
Yeah.
You just wonder what the hell were these guys thinking they were doing.
I know. Well, they were at least trying to inject some humor into it, you know, which is a Beatles trait as well, you know, to have some humor. But it's just being channeled in the wrong direction.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they thought they were auditioning for a comedy show.
Well, that's as I said, you know, were they sort of thinking TV coming up and being on one of these variety shows, you know, but surely not. You know, this was never what they were about, never what they intended to be.
No, that was all a byproduct, but they wanted to make records.
I think this is why Brian, it was like, well, it can't be the Beatles who made that decision. So it must have been Brian pushing them to do these sort of novelty numbers.
Because it was such an anomaly when you consider the sets that they would put together for varying venues, you know, whether it's before the Royals or for BBC Radio or Ed Sullivan or whatever, how much more thoughtful they were.
Mm.
And this one just seems to be completely wrongheaded.
I mean, think of the Cavanites who, you know, had to subsequently watch the Beatles get all smoothed out and all the rough edges knocked off and be this kind of happy, smiling mop tops and, you know, thinking like, right, you know, this is not who they are. But can you imagine if they'd have heard this Decca audition?
Well, that's the thing. Some raw edges would have been to their benefit this day.
Yeah.
But they're not there. It's just anemic.
Biting up a nickel candy bar, talking all about how sharp they are, these
three cool cats, three cool chicks, three cool chicks.
I'm walking down the street, I'm swinging their hips, splitting up a bag of potato chips, and three cool cats did three big flips for
three cool chicks.
Well, about
the first cool cat. He said, man, look at that. Man, do you see what I see? Well, I want that middle chick.
I want that little chick.
Hey, man, do you have one chick for me?
Hey. Well, three cool chicks. Three cool chicks. Well, they look like angels from up above. And three cool cats really fell in love. But three cool chicks made three fools out. Three cool cats. Three cool cats. Well, I popped that first cool cat. He said, man, look at that. Man, do you see what I see? Well, now I want that middle chick.
I want that little chick.
Hey, man, say one chick for me.
Yeah.
Three cool chicks. Three cool chicks.
Another good moment following this was they're taking on what had been a recent posthumous Buddy Holly hit.
Yes.
Crying, Waiting, Hoping.
Right, which had been part of the Apartment tapes, right, that he'd recorded just before he died in New York.
Yeah, late 1958. Yes. It's just him on a professional recorder.
Yeah.
Just routining a bunch of new compositions as well as a couple of covers.
Yeah.
And it's anybody, if you get the chance to hear this, I don't think it's officially been put out.
No.
I mean, I've got a bootleg set that's
yeah,
got
I've got the whole thing as well. Yeah. It's pure.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And of course, that would not do for the marketplace. So you had Norman Petty getting the Fireballs involved in trying to make this into commercial release worthy material.
Make it sound like the Crickets.
Yeah.
And
I shouldn't crucify him too much for that because I mean, if nothing else, it caught the Beatles' ear when they heard that single released.
Yeah.
And they did the released version, Fireballs, augmenting Buddy Holly of Crying, Waiting, Hoping.
Yes.
Which I thought was so beautifully suited to their strengths as a performing unit.
Yeah.
You know, George taking the lead vocal, replicating and nailing that guitar solo.
Yes.
Which is great.
Yes.
Which was not Buddy, unfortunately, on the released version. But also the call and response vocals.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great, great version. I always thought it was funny. You know, once I kind of knew the history, when you see La Bamba, which is a fine enough entertaining movie, I prefer it to the Buddy Holly story, which is garbage.
Right.
I know a lot of people like that, but it so misses the mark in terms of, you know, ringing true. But anyway,
You got a film without Norman Petty in it about Buddy Holly.
Yeah, and the Crickets, you know, being these anonymous guys and not even the full band.
Good performance by Gary Busey. It's not very Holly-like, but
nothing. Yeah, exactly. Right. That's what ruins it for me.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, he's playing somebody else.
Right.
You know, he should have given it a different name and called it something else because he sure
the
as hell
Hank Marvin story.
You know, you don't put big frame glasses in somebody and automatically make them Buddy Holly. You know, that's what he did, and he was so wrong.
Yeah.
Anyway, in La Bamba, you've got the wonderful Marshall Crenshaw playing Buddy Holly.
Yes.
And being the big Beatle head that he is, he, in his set, is doing Crying, Waiting, Hoping, which the real Buddy Holly never did live, of course, because it was a recent composition. He hadn't properly recorded at that point. But I think it was sort of a nod to us Beatle people.
Mm.
Like, you know, we know about this Beatle recording, which hadn't come out yet, so here it is.
I always remember a great review of La Bamba where it praised the film, but it said that they thought they overstated the tragedy that goes on in the story. It said it makes it look like the death of Ritchie Valens as the greatest musical tragedy since the demise of Mozart.
Well, and not to mention they're casting Lou Diamond Phillips, who in no way resembled the real Ritchie Valens.
Right.
But that said, you know, it's funny when I saw that movie, that whole sort of a sub-theme of his fear of flying because the dreams he have of the plane crashing over school, that really happened.
Right.
Which that totally looks like a Hollywood contrivance, but it actually really happened.
Yeah.
There's actually a recording of that.
Mm.
There was like a school assembly going on when these two planes collided over his school.
Yeah.
And you hear it. So pretty amazing. Anyway, a great, great reading of this song. And I'm glad that they eventually re-recorded it with Ringo for the BBC.
Yeah.
But this has always been one of my favorite covers of theirs.
So what we'll play here is, first of all, from the Apartment tapes, Buddy Holly performing the song.
Buddy Holly naked.
Yeah, Buddy Holly naked, exactly. Then with the overdubs by the Fireballs.
Yes.
And then the Beatles version for Decca.
Crying, waiting, hoping you'll come back. I just can't seem to get you off my mind. Crying, waiting, hoping
You'll come back, you're the one I love, and I think about you all the time. Crying,
crying,
my tears keep a falling all night long. Waiting,
waiting,
it feels so useless, I know it's wrong to keep a
crying, crying, waiting, waiting,
hoping,
hoping
you'll come back, baby, someday soon. Things will change and you'll be mine.
Tears keep on falling all night long. Wait,
wait,
do, do, do.
It seems so useless, I know it's wrong.
We're crying,
crying,
waiting,
waiting,
hoping,
hoping
you come back.
Well, maybe someday soon.
Things will change and you'll be mine.
Crying,
crying,
waiting,
waiting,
hoping.
Now we come to, I know, one of your favourite performances.
It is, actually.
Is it really?
I do like the song.
Oh, yeah. I was taking the piss.
No. Use the bathroom, please.
As I want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love of the Loved.
Which was not released on Anthology, oddly enough.
Yeah,
but I always thought this was a standout composition. It's pretty sophisticated.
It is sophisticated. I just don't particularly like it. It's kind of awkward sounding. I'm not surprised that they didn't deem it worthy for themselves to record.
Well, it's obviously got some commercial appeal to it. This is not an empty throwaway song. You know, whether it was suited for the Beatles or not, one can argue. But I've never been much of a fan of Cilla Black.
No, very nasal singer.
Well, just strident.
Yeah, that's her shrieking.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it just makes me want to cover my ears. But in the hands of another singer, somebody I think could have done a good job with this. I could see McCartney with his musical taste toward Peggy Lee, Sarah Vaughan, Dinah Washington, that a real singer he could have heard doing this song.
Yeah.
So maybe he wrote it not really intending it to be a Beatles song, but you know, sort of an early eye to shopping his material out to other artists.
But also, the arrangement for the Cilla Black version, I just hate it.
George Martin?
Yeah, it's just a really kind of cack-handed pop arrangement. Doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
And clearly record buyers thought similarly. In October of 63, it made number 30 in the UK charts, which was basically a flop.
Yeah.
It was her debut single.
At a time when Lennon McCartney as a songwriting team
were
pretty hot.
Yeah, and Swingin' Cilla, this was not part of her repertoire at all.
No. But I do like the Beatles version. I'm glad that we've got a version of them doing it.
I'm glad we've got it. It's just not one of my favorite performances of theirs at all.
Love of the love.
September in the Rain.
Yeah.
Now, that's a very interesting thing for them to take on.
I know. Dinah Washington from 1961.
Yeah.
Like, again, but guess who's the one who's taking it on?
Of course. I love that scatting he does at the beginning of it. It's so, God, it's so Paul.
I know.
I mean, clearly he's reached a comfort level in the session by this time.
One, two, two.
Plus ça change.
Okay, you say so. But again, it's one of these sort of jazz pop singers that he's listening to. So It really speaks well to the Beatles, you know, diversity of taste that they're willing to take this stuff on. You know, I don't see any of these songs, as much as you could say, well, John and George were the rockers of the band. I don't think any of them had to be shoved down their throats to do.
Right.
I think they were comfortable doing them, sort of recognizing the big picture.
A bit like Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah.
5 years later.
We'll trust in Paul, for better or worse. Yeah, Dinah Washington.
Yeah, we'll trust in Paul and then throw him under the bus when it doesn't work out.
Yeah. She's best known for that song, What a Difference a Day Made.
Yes.
Yeah, which is, I guess, pretty much her signature song.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years ago there was a thing in Mad Magazine where they were doing a thing on sheet music covers we'd like to see.
Yes.
And so for What a Difference a Day Made, the photo they had on it was...
Is it What a Difference a Day Makes?
Make, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm vamping here. Anyway, for that song, the picture they had on the cover of the sheet music was John F. Kennedy in Dallas.
Oh,
in his motorcade.
Wow.
Yeah, perfect, right?
Oh, very nice.
Actually, oddly enough, she ended up dying young, like within a month of the Kennedy assassination, Dinah Washington. It was a drug overdose, although I don't think they ever clearly established it was a suicide. It was just one of these, you know, kind of a Brian Epstein-like bad combination of things.
The leaves of brown came tumbling down, remember, in September, in the rain. The sun went out just like a dying ember, that September. In the rain, to every word of love I heard you whisper, the raindrops seem to play a sweet refrain.
For spring is here, to me it's still September. Oh, that September.
So now we get to the two closing numbers, both the Coasters. And the first one is Besame Mucho, which, you know,
didn't originate with the Coasters, of course. You're going back to World War II for this song, which was actually composed in Spanish. And it was actually done for a movie in 1943. We'll play a little bit of the original so you get a sense that, again, somebody, this song caught their ears and they decided to repurpose it to rock and roll, which takes a pretty big leap in imagination. But here you got the Coasters then doing it, you know, over a decade later in the 1950s. And I believe it was a B-side when they ended up
– it was actually 1960.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So when the Beatles picked up on it – and, of course, they're big B-side listeners of the the records that they like.
Yeah.
And
it's just surprising at how much legs that song had with the Beatles. You know, they do it at the first EMI session.
Yeah.
And it's even there. There's Paul sort of vamping on it in Let It Be.
Yeah. Star Club.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've got an array of performances. I think even on an early BBC session, they did it maybe with Pete Best.
Well, the way that they did belt it, you can imagine it was very popular with the fans.
Sure.
But still, it's
Paul would
amazing.
Say how it was revelatory to him as a songwriter to listen to that going from minor to major.
Right.
And that was the thing that sort of like that, just the way it can turn a song.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was what made it really appealing to him. It's like, wow, that's a cool trick.
Cha-cha-boom.
Yeah. And so here you've got it before they really started, you know, working all those little artifacts into the performance. As they would by the time they recorded at the end of the year at the Star Club.
I love that bit, actually, in Anthology, where you see Paul and George in 95 in the studio,
mm-hmm.
and they just cut in that little bit of film of them going cha-cha-boom.
Yeah.
So all the way through to the mid-90s, echoes of Besame Mucho.
Bésame muito, quero sentir os teus lábios juntinhos aos meus.
Bésame, bésame, bésame mucho. Hold me, my darling, and say that you'll always be mine. Dearest one, if you should leave me, each little dream would take wings and my life would be through.
Then we close with the final tune recorded that day, returning one more time to the Coasters' well, Searchin'.
Yeah.
A Libra Stoller song.
Yes.
So you can't blame this on going back to World War II.
Well, you know, the Coasters had their biggest hits with Libra and Stoller,
not only
in terms of the writing, but the production.
Another Coasters connection is the guy who played sax on a lot of their songs, King Curtis.
Yeah.
King Curtis Interruptus.
Yakety Yak.
Yes. And who, of course, would work with John Lennon right before his death in 1971 for the Imagine album.
As mentioned on a previous show.
As well as toured with him in 65 as an opening act.
Yes.
Yes. So connections there, folks.
Mm-hmm.
6 Degrees of Beatles. Searchin', this is another song that, again, you got a lot of vocals going on in it. But, again, that whole comedy aspect and the funny voices, you know, like a bulldog drumming.
I know. That falsetto piece.
Yeah.
Yes,
yikes.
Really out there.
I mean, you want to talk about the most cringeworthy Beatle recordings on tape.
Yeah.
This would be one of them.
Gonna find her. see me coming. Gonna walk right down that street like a bulldog drumming. I'm searching, yeah, I'm searching. My goodness, searching every way. Yeah, yeah, but I got not rest my day. You know I'll bring her in some.
I think I told you before that when, you know, I was at the Take It Away video shoot in 82.
Yeah.
That was just after Paul had been on Desert Island Discs.
Oh, did he name this one?
And he'd, yeah, mentioned Searching and said that in the cavern, you know, he sort of mimicked the girls going, play Searching, Paul. And so when we were at the video shoot and there was a break in filming and Paul and the band were just basically, you know, improvising on stage, mm-hmm. and taking requests. Amazing. You know, there we were basically calling out requests.
Do you play Far, Far Away?
And people were shouting out, play Searching, Paul.
Really?
Yeah.
So they
and
knew
he did,
that?
And he did. He went into it and played Searching that day.
Did you tape it?
No. You see, I play by the rules.
Yeah.
No bootlegging.
Where did it get you? So at least they didn't do a Long Came Jones. Although doing there's a riot going on would have been a cool tone. Yep, that was Coasters back in the Robbins days.
Yeah. Anyway, we digress.
We do. So here you are now. You've got this tape, 15 songs for them to consider. Now, Mike Smith, before a successful career as lead singer of the Dave Clark Five.
Oh, yeah, right. Don't confuse people.
Right. No, he was sort of an assistant to Dick Rowe.
Yeah.
At Decca. And Decca, you know, Dick Rowe was an A&R guy. He was an older guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he was 36 at the time of this. He looked older. Mm. Mike Smith was a younger guy, and he was the one sort of doing the heavy lifting.
He was the one who went to the cavern.
Yes, on December 13th, 1961.
Yeah.
Said it was, you know, pouring rain, the long queue around the block, and that kind of daunted him. But he really was sort of the champion, if there can be said to be one at Decca, of the Beatles.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to sign them. And ultimately, it came down to the logistics of, you know, who can we work with? The local guys, the Tremolos, who auditioned that day as well.
Mm-hmm.
And whose tape I would love to hear that was made that day.
Oh, God. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Really?
Yeah.
That's never
Why
isn't
that
out.
The bootleg? Right.
Would anyone be really interested apart from us?
History. Brian Poole and the Tremolos.
Yes.
Yes. Who, it's funny, after a string of years of putting out records with them, he quits to go solo.
Yeah.
Ends up working in a butcher shop.
Of course.
Right. The Tremolos have their biggest hits in America subsequent to that.
Right.
Here Comes My Baby,
yeah.
The Cat Stevens song in 67,
yeah.
Followed by Silence is Golden.
Yes.
Which had been a four-season song.
Mind Your Business.
What's that? Is that a track?
No, it's a line in the song.
Which one?
Mind Your Business.
Yeah. Have you ever heard the Four Seasons version?
No.
No, it's not too dissimilar, as you imagine, with that falsetto vocal. But, I was pretty fond of that.
Here Comes My Baby is cool because it's like a live feel to that.
Yes. Yeah. Like the Beach Boys party.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Feigning, you know, excitement in the studio. Like that song. But it's funny is they had recorded a version of something off of Revolver in 66. Do you recall this? In a desperate attempt to get a hit and be contemporary, didn't quite work.
I like your frame, a desperate attempt. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. Okay, know this about them. So they get signed on the basis of they're local, and we're not going to deal with these guys that are
Londoners.
Hours away.
Yeah.
Right.
So some of those bloody Northerners.
So January 1st is the audition for them as well as the Beatles. They get signed. Their first single is released on April 20th, 1962. At which time the Beatles have just suffered the loss of Stuart Sutcliffe and they're in Germany right now.
Yeah.
So it's a song called Twist Little Sister, and it's by the songwriting partnership of John Beveridge and Peter Oakman.
I see.
Do you ever hear those guys?
No, I thought maybe this was a kind of mashup of Twist and Shout and
well, that's the thing.
And Little Sister.
A lot of their early records were like dance songs.
Yeah.
Anyway, so those are the guys that wrote A Picture of You that Joe Brown recorded.
Yeah.
Anyway, it stiffs. It does not chart. So here's Decca, what they must be thinking. Oh, we picked these guys with the Beatles. It wasn't until their fifth
single. Well, they wouldn't be thinking that because the Beatles haven't done anything yet.
No. But they wouldn't until the fall. That's true.
Yeah.
So, but by the time they finally charted with a hit, we're talking July of 63.
Yeah.
By which time, the Beatles own the charts.
Oh, yes.
And what do the Tremolo's first score with as a hit? A cover of the Beatles cover of Twist and Shout, which goes to number 4. It took them their fifth single to get a hit to do well. And it was followed up by a cover of The Contours' Do You Love Me, which then was covered by the DC5.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're doing these sort of dancey songs, which is not, you know, at least in America, when we think of the Tremolos, we think of the aforementioned Here Comes My Baby and Silence is Golden. We don't think of this, you know, English band covering American R&B dance songs.
Right.
But that's what they were, apparently, at least in the early years. That was what got them some attention.
And they were safe. That's really the sound that you're hearing.
Right. Yeah. But the Beatles, by the time the Tremolos are having their first hits, are doing it with original material.
Yeah.
You know, their album goes to number one, stays there for half the year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's about the point where they must be kicking themselves.
Right.
Now, it's interesting that it's Dick Rowe, who is the sort of public face of the rejection of the Beatles. And he's the one who gets pilloried for it until George, in a great act of mercy, steers him to the Rolling Stones to sort of redeem himself.
Mm.
But he also would later on say that he'd never heard that Brian Epstein had committed to buying 3,000 copies of the first thing the Beatles recorded for Decca.
Yeah.
He said, had I known that,
yeah,
it would have been a different story.
Yes. Well, thank goodness it wasn't, because as very well detailed in Lewison's book, Decca would have been all wrong for the Beatles. You know, the way that fortuitously everything turned out right for them with EMI, you know, be it, you know, George Martin as the producer, the engineers they had, the technical staff there who were willing, you know, to innovate, you know, as the years went on.
And having Pete Best in the group.
Right.
Not that he'd be recording with them, but he'd still be part of the package. And if they were having hit records with him, if that were to happen, then they're going to be harder pressed to get rid of him.
Yeah. I mean, imagine that, you know, sequence in A Hard Day's Night, Pete's theme.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we've heard Pete's theme. We've played it on a show. But Mike Smith, I mean, they acknowledged it as much as everybody else has, that it was really their lucky break.
Yeah.
He was one that said later on, you know, it was really a good thing that they didn't get signed.
Mm.
He goes, I couldn't have worked with them the way George Martin did. I would have got too involved in their bad parts and not enough in their good.
Wow.
And that's just the way it would have gone at the time.
So what he means, like trying to improve the bad
parts. Instead of taking them as they were and sort of steering them to their strengths and sort of facilitating the latent talent.
Yeah.
So
he would have been like sort of barking at Pete, take away his bass pedal.
Right. He would have been doing a camphor on them.
Yeah.
Right.
Can you imagine? I mean, the start of what you're doing with no bass pedal.
Right. The Sound of Silence. He would say later on about the Beatles, I did meet them subsequently, and they gave me a two-finger salute.
And it wasn't the peace sign.
No, not at all. But, you know, Mike Smith was not an untalented guy. He had quite the run of hits. He did produce the Tremolos with and without Brian Poole. Hmm. But, you know, Marmalade's cover, ironically, of Obladi Oblada,
yes,
went to number one. He produced it. As well as Georgie Fame doing Ballad of Bonnie and Clyde, another number one hit. So,
Was that a hit over here in the States, by the way?
It was a chart hit, but not a number one.
Right.
Yeah. But he has since passed on. He died in 2011.
Yeah.
Dick Rowe died in the 80s.
Yeah.
What was Lennon's line? I hope he kicks himself to death.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't know if that – do we know if that's actually an accurate quote or another one of these
things
that's
been
attributed?
That was in Love Me Do, wasn't it? In the Michael Brown book?
Ah, is it? Okay.
I think so, yeah. I hope he kicks – I think it was George said, I bet he's kicking himself now.
Yeah, and he said, yeah, I hope he kicks himself to death.
I mean, it does have the ring of truth about it as coming from Lennon, does it not? Would you sign this band?
And that's a great question, actually. Yeah. Listening to that, it's hard to say because we have to be in the beginning of 1962 in the UK,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking for not the next big thing necessarily, but at least a band that can do adequate cover versions of American hits.
It seemed that they showed incredible patience with these guys, allowing them four flop singles before pressing on and getting the hit out of them.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I don't know, would Parlophone have done that with the Beatles? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
I think they originally committed to one single, maybe two, and then once the second one was this massive hit, then they said, okay, you're going to greenlight you for an album.
Now, we have to remember that the Beatles left the audition not thinking they've screwed up. They've left the audition thinking they're going to get signed because they're getting very positive noises from Mike Smith. Mm-hmm. They think it's just a formality at this point.
Exactly. And as did Brian going into it, because he's such a big customer as the manager of NEMS, you know, buying all these Decca records. And I think – I don't know if it was before or after. Wasn't there this implicit threat that I might stop buying Decca records if you don't sign my voice?
Right, yeah.
Which he couldn't have done anyway.
Right.
I mean, you know, if a hit record is on Decca, you're going to have to sell it.
Yeah.
But what I always thought was an interesting thing that when you look at the history of Decca records and what was going on, you know, Mike Smith, if he was – personally signed to the Beatles because it was Dick Rowe that got approached as A&R guy. There were other producers at Decca. There was, in fact, an American producer who was working for the label, Shel Tomey.
Oh, absolutely. He went on to produce The Kinks and The Who.
Right. His specialty was capturing these raucous acts.
Mm-hmm.
So here you've got, you know, if he'd seen the Beatles at the Cavern, he could have totally captured that act, you know, the club act as we have on the Star Club.
Yeah.
It would have been pre-Ringo. Mm. But can you imagine Shel Tomey producing the Beatles?
I know. Well, I interviewed Shel a few years ago and he said he arrived in Britain in 62 and it was like right on the cusp of big things happening, but he had no clue of that. And if I recall correctly, he told me that Nick Vinay knew he was going to go to the UK.
Knew Shel was going there?
Yeah. And basically gave him, you know, a tape of various sort of productions, Capitol productions. And when Shel landed in the UK and went to Decca, he basically played this tape as if it was his own production.
Yeah, as a sort of credentials to get hired as a producer.
Correct.
Yeah, a bit of subterfuge there.
Yeah.
I would have loved to know what Capitol records he brought with him.
I know. And, but, you know, kudos to him that he was able to back up the bluff.
Yeah.
You know, and basically
fake it till you make it.
Yeah, exactly. And he was just there at the right time, as he said. Unbelievable. He didn't realize everything was just going to explode.
Yeah. Yeah. So he missed out on the Beatles, but I think he did okay for himself.
Yeah.
So, and I think the Beatles did okay for themselves.
They certainly did. And as we said, they did much better for themselves by not being signed by Decca. But little did they know that at the time.
No, they did not. And here, as a portent of things to come, you've got them. It's in February that they find out that Decca has turned them down.
Mm.
And at that time, as bitterly disappointed as they are, and Brian is crushed because he was certain he had it in the bag.
Yeah.
They do not tell Pete Best.
Right.
He finds out much later on.
I know. So that shows you right there.
The long range thinking.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Although, how would that have impacted things by telling Pete that they got turned down? That's not going to change
it. It's not going to change anything, but it just shows how tightly knit the band was.
Yeah.
It was three guys and another guy. You know, these three guys are the ones plotting their future.
It's just really weird, isn't it, that it doesn't come up at all in conversation in front of Pete.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why would they have said, well, let's keep it secret? There doesn't seem to be a purpose to that. So if they didn't just bother sharing it, it was just like no one got round to telling him.
No, I think it's by design, clearly.
Yeah.
I mean, well, probably because they didn't want Mona to know. Oh, and God. Get her claws deeper into them.
Have her being a right Mona. As Neil would find out.
Well, yeah, I think he knew pretty well. Yeah, when you reverse engineer that, now, the boy born at the end of July, go back 9 months, this would have been a pre-deck audition.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like he was celebrating a successful audition that day.
No, no, he was actually
Which is not to say that they didn't.
He was on a pre-audition high.
Yeah, the work was already done.
Yeah.
Spring in his step. Clearly, it was not something that would have been advantageous to be signed by Decca.
No.
Although you do wonder what they could have done differently that would have made a better impression.
Well, we've already said if they'd have just stuck to their strengths.
Well, in terms of being a performing act, but also different material they could have done.
I suppose they were concerned as well. If they were just going to be the leather-clad rocker material, you know, that it would make them look dated.
Maybe. I suppose, because that was something they were clinging to. It's this vestige of authentic rock and roll from the 50s.
Right.
The big question mark in my mind is, what if Mike Smith had managed to get into the Cavern and seen them and was willing to evangelize to the label? We've got to sign these guys. They're dynamite. You should see what they're doing to a crowd. You know, we really need to get something out of this, even if it doesn't, you know, translate to vinyl. You know, these guys are going to be phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, as we said, though, for all of the hypothesizing, it really doesn't matter this what if, because we know that they actually did better.
So yeah, it turned out for the best.
Yeah, so it's not a kind of, oh, if only.
No,
like, no. We're actually really glad.
No, the if only is if Ryan hadn't died.
Yes, correct.
This is Robert Rodriguez.
This is Richard Buskin.
And this has been
Something About the Beatles.
Something About the Beatles, produced at Studio Media Recording, engineered by Scott Steinman, executive producer Rick Wynn. Title song by The Corgis.
Was a top record executive in London in 1962. Mr. Thigh, you've been known for many, many years as the man who turned down the Ruttles.
Yeah, that's right.
You said that guitar groups were on their way out and would never make any money at all in the 60s.
Yes, I did.
You turned your back on all those millions of sales, all those hundreds of gold records.
Yeah, that's right.
What's it like to be such an asshole?
What?